Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. I'm Paul Riesmandel. I'm your host on today's program. John Anderson is back to catch us up with what's been going on with unlicensed radio so far this year. It's going to be a good show, so you do want to stay tuned. So, John, thanks once again coming on in here, this time to catch up on what's going on with regard to Unlicensed, also known as Pirate Radio.
Oh, it's always a pleasure.
Because you've had a chance to update your enforcement action database, which is your database of what actions the Federal Communications Commission has taken in contacting and attempting to close down unlicensed broadcast radio stations in these United States.
Correct.
And you compile this database by using the public information put out by the FCC.
And press reports.
And press reports, okay. And what so in terms of from the FCC, what data are you relying on?
There are two basic forms of data that the FCC puts out with regard to pirate stations. The first one is the warning letters that they issue to radio stations. They publish these all on a specific section of the webpage in the Enforcement Bureau's part of the FCC website, and they update it regularly, monthly. They say when they visited the radio station, why they visited the radio station, and the fact that the radio station is breaking the law. They also publish escalation letters, for example, notices of apparent liability, which basically say, we've warned you, now we're going to fine you if you don't shut down. And then they also publish the forfeiture notices, the actual fines that they say. So, and in those fine documents, actually, they often put additional information, how many times the FCC actually went and visited, and sometimes it's more than once. What the process has done and how long it's taken the process to go. And I basically use all of that information to collect data points on when the FCC visits stations, when they send letters, and how often they escalate to fines. And then the second form of data is, of course, press reports, where local newspapers or something run, you know, one of these wonderful law and order stories about how the local law enforcement, say, for example, in Florida or New Jersey, have closed a Haitian pirate radio station.
Have there been any reports from New Jersey? Because those are the two states in the country that have state laws making it illegal to broadcast without a license. They're the only two states with such laws. And there's been a lot of action down in Florida, which has a very vibrant, shall we say,
yes,
active unlicensed radio community, partially due to lots of immigrants from the Caribbean,
yes,
where running unlicensed stations is kind of a way of life.
Right.
And it's frowned upon a bit more in Florida. But New Jersey is the second state to do that, and I've heard a lot less about enforcement in New Jersey.
Well, it's interesting. Whereas the state and local authorities in Florida are actively going out and working with the FCC and hunting and busting pirate radio stations on a somewhat regular basis, at least maybe a couple, three, four, five, six a year, maybe a few more. In New Jersey, the local and state authorities have not taken New Jersey's anti-pirate law and run with it like they have in Florida. That does not mean that there hasn't been enforcement action in Florida. In fact, New Jersey, according to the statistics that I have, is the fourth most populous state in the United States when it comes to micro radio activity based on the amount of enforcement actions conducted there. And these are primarily FCC visits from either the Philadelphia office or more typically the New York office of
the
FCC.
Are there indications that the local police or local sheriffs
No.
have been? So,
No.
So really it seems
the FCC.
To be still FCC.
It is still the FCC that is primarily going out and looking for and hunting down and attempting to bust pirates in New Jersey. But the frequency by which they are visiting the state is increasing in a degree that I'm not seeing in other states.
Now, could that be because the New Jersey broadcasters are very organized, and they're organized partially because they sit in the shadow of New York and Philadelphia and
yes,
they fight very hard for advertising revenue and are therefore very protective of what little market they have. They're the ones who fought and lobbied for the law against pirates. Do you think that they are part of the reason the FCC is there in New Jersey so much is because the New Jersey broadcasters are filing reports, are making complaints, and keeping the pressure on the FCC.
Yes, I think that that definitely plays into it. I mean, the FCC stated protocol when it comes to actually enforcing the unlicensed broadcast prohibition is that they only act on the basis of complaints. So it takes notification, typically by someone external of the FCC, to actually instigate a case and get the FCC involved. So if you see more FCC visits, you typically can correlate that that means that there has been more complaints to the FCC. Now, in the documents that the FCC provides, they do not say who provided the complaint information.
So it's all conjecture.
All it says is a complaint was received that an unlicensed broadcasting station is operating on this frequency in this community. On X date, we went out and visited it, and we nailed it to this address.
But in looking at it realistically, the people who would know where to complain and how to complain about an unlicensed broadcasters are more likely to be broadcasters.
Yes. And I also think that possibly the reason why we've seen an increase of micro broadcast activity in FCC enforcement action in New Jersey has something to do with the changing demographics of the New York metropolitan area. A lot of pirate activity, unsurprisingly, is centered in Newark. Newark is has been a depressed city.
Very depressed city.
It is economically disadvantaged, and as such, it collects a lot of people who are depressed and economically disadvantaged.
And there's also historically been a pretty large Caribbean community.
Yes. And so,
in that region.
So there are elements of the population that are more predisposed to engage in unlicensed broadcast activity, and those populations are growing more, say, in Newark or Elizabeth, or, you know, places like that, than the East Orange, than they are in the New York metropolitan
right.
area, with the exception of Brooklyn, which is an area where a lot of pirate activity is located in Manhattan itself.
All those communities in New Jersey are all very urban. I'm a former New Jerseyan before coming to the Midwest. Those are all very urban northern areas, all centered around really close to New York City across the river from the Hudson.
Little Egg Harbor, New Jersey.
Now, Little Egg Harbor is not remotely urban. Little Egg Harbor is a shore community, about central shore part of the state. It's a small tourist community right there on the ocean.
So the FCC was there in July, too.
That's unlikely to be, I mean, not that there aren't economically disadvantaged people in small shore communities. That's less likely to be, you know, say, a Caribbean or Haitian
sure.
station or a Dominican station, and more likely to be someone who is possibly more white, middle, or working class, putting their own station on.
Yeah, well, the guy's name is Sean.
Yeah.
Ekstat.
Okay.
It's public knowledge, right. So everyone's name is located up here, and Sean Ekstat does not necessarily strike me as
so you're seeing a lot in New Jersey, but that's only four. And just for background, how long have you been keeping this database?
10 years. I started in 1997 when I originally got online, and it was a project that I just undertook out of curiosity. And as the years have gone on, I've started to be able to actually spot trends in the amount of enforcement that the FCC engages in and the type of enforcement that the FCC engages in. And so now, not only do I look at the database as a way of just collecting where the FCC's been and who's been bothered, but also as a way to give micro broadcasters better knowledge as to how the FCC enforcement process works and how they can better analyze the potential chances and assess the risks of taking to the air without a license.
It's not an act of intelligence.
It's right. an act of counterintelligence.
It's not unlike truckers sharing data on speed
smoking
traps
reports. Yeah,
and
absolutely.
Things like that. Because there are patterns, because the FCC cannot be everywhere. It mm-hmm. does focus its efforts. There are offices that are more active than others, and therefore there's only so much that can be done. And I think it's also what's great about the data you put out is it demystifies, right? Because too often people have the image in their heads. They think of the Pump the Volume movie.
Orange bread trucks with FCC
right,
stenciled
right,
on the
right,
side,
exactly.
screaming through town.
Yeah,
right.
Chasing Christian Slater in his Jeep broadcasting station with, you know, four or five trucks all trying to converge on, and they have this vision in their head that the FCC is like the DEA or the ATF,
and they're not. They're
and
not that.
They're
at
much
all.
More like the Interstate Commerce Commission or even the EPA.
Right. Yeah, they do not have police powers. That's the largest myth about the Federal Communications Commission and their field agents. Yes, they carry badges. Yes, they have identity cards, but they do not have the police powers that go with them. Nor the police training. Although some field agents, and it is a trend that the FCC is doing, is they are sending their field agents to federal law enforcement training centers. Yes.
So how long has this been going on?
I would have to look that up, but it's been going on for probably at least the past 3 or 4 years. The FCC has mentioned that they are doing that.
Because to get those CB high banders?
Either that, yeah, you know, maybe they rolled up on somebody's place in North Dakota and they entered the door with a shotgun.
Well, there have been those problems. Yeah, there have been places like Montana and North Dakota, especially.
You know, especially some of the, you know, militia patriot pirate types that talk about, you know, you're only going to come after me once you get through my M16 and cache of ammo. Yeah, but they're not cops. They do not have powers of arrest. They cannot go into a building on probable cause. They require a warrant, and once they get that warrant, they cannot execute that warrant themselves. A federal marshal, an actual police officer, has to be there present to actually provide the police power so that the FCC can do its job. And when it comes to things like fining pirates, they issue a lot of different fines where they say, oh, we've fined this guy $10,000. That's fine and dandy, but the FCC has no power to actually garnish your income or otherwise collect on that fine in such a way as to make you pay.
They're
not the IRS. They don't have those powers. So they have to go and get a local, federal attorney to prosecute the case on behalf of the government. And that, again, puts the enforcement power outside of the FCC's own bounds and makes it hard for them to escalate and truly exercise the muscle that I think would be required to take stations off the air.
Because hunting down unlicensed broadcasters is really just a tiny sliver of the FCC's duties, which are mostly regulatory in nature and much more bureaucratic in nature.
Do you know what the FCC's been up to most this summer as far as enforcement actions go? They've been going into electronic stores and making sure that people that sell analog TVs are putting stickers on those TVs that say this TV will no longer work after February 19th, 2009. Because of the DTV transition.
And indeed, that's a big deal. And that's Congress has really been hot on that particular issue.
And so because of the political consternation around the DTV transition, field agents have been going out with clipboards into Best Buys and Walmarts and Costco's and looking at the television sections and seeing if there are labels on them. And they've been issuing notices of violation. They've issued fines for this. I mean, these are labor-intensive actions that take away from the other things that the FCC has to do, of which, as you said, pirate radio enforcement is just a small, small piece.
So you mentioned that New Jersey is number 4 this year out of the top states and pirate activity. Is it safe to assume that Florida is number 1?
No, New York is number 1.
New York is really number 1.
New York is the number 1 hotbed of pirate activity as a state.
Surprising.
It's actually something that's been developing as a trend over the last couple of years. I think this is partially due to the fact that the FCC agents in Florida pretty much know that they're overrun. And while they obviously get a lot of complaints about pirates, they can only address a limited number. And they have really hoped, and it's on the record, the Tampa District Office Director said, we're really happy the state law has been passed because now we don't have to even get involved. But the local and state authorities haven't picked up the ball like the broadcasters would have liked and pushed for a full-on military police state assault against pirate broadcasters.
Well, because they have things like actual violent crime to worry about.
Yes, and so
crimes that have actual victims to worry about in Florida, in addition to the victimless crime of unlicensed radio.
Meanwhile, in New York City, the number of active stations and the number of active frequencies have exploded.
And then is that your evaluation based upon enforcement actions, or is there other data informing
There is other data informing that. There is some friends of ours, Free 103.9, which started out as a micro radio station in the Williamsburg neighborhood of Brooklyn and has now expanded to be a large transmission arts collective.
Yeah, I don't think they don't really transmit any longer except
online.
Well,
they do transmit, but they typically use very low power levels and multiple transmitters. But they run a very informative news blog of their own where they track various radio related issues. And one of the things which they did is about a month or so ago, they wrote an article where they took information off of New York area bulletin boards where radio engineers and broadcast professionals swap industry news, you know, informally online on some, you know, bulletin board that's been set up for some use, you know, just chit chat, chatter, as you may call it. And they went through the chatter about pirate broadcasters over the summer, and they found that in the New York City metropolitan area alone, 24 active frequencies are in use.
Wow.
Now, that doesn't mean there's just 24 pirate stations in New York.
It just means there are 24 frequencies, and, which could have multiple pirates per frequency.
And they do. Some pirates go on the air from 8 to 4, and then that station will shut down, and another pirate station will come on overnight.
So you're starting to see some
time sharing.
Some sharing, which is pretty progressive.
Yes. And I mean, but that is a way that the spectrum is being used in a somewhat collaborative manner to accommodate more voices.
You know, that's a lot like shortwave pirates do it. Shortwave pirate communities tend to be a bit more of a community as such rather than just these autonomous people. And partially because there aren't so many shortwave listeners, and so the shortwave pirates are often just broadcasting to one another, but they do a time-sharing kind of thing. They let each other know in various ways that they'll be using a frequency at a particular time.
Right.
And because the issue of interference is much bigger when you're talking about, you know, frequencies that cover entire continents, it's interesting to see this taking place in New York. Do you have any sense that there's any above ground signs of collaboration and frequency sharing, or is it sort of an ad hoc kind of thing? I know this guy is on this frequency every day from 4 to 8, so I know if I go on at 9, I'm clean. Do you have any clue?
No, I think that it's pretty much people are just listening to the radio, deciding where they see open spots, and possibly, you know, mapping those open spots over time. For example, one of the pirates that has been singled out for demonstrating the activity that takes place on time sharing is the frequency of 91.9 FM. WHUT, a hip-hop station, uses the frequency evenings between 10 p.m. and midnight. Meanwhile, a Hasidic pirate, a Hasidic Jewish pirate, is using the frequency much of the rest of the week.
So they're definitely trading off.
Yeah, but when one is on the air, the other is not. And when the Hasidic pirate signs off, WHUT comes on. Now, there's probably a gap between the two. I'm assuming that the Hasidic pirate maybe broadcasts during the day.
It seems like that would really complicate things to the FCC, because it represents not just a multiplication of the number of pirates you have, but it also means that you have these narrowing windows in which you can begin to track them. Because certainly in order to track down, aside from, you know, some basic police work, which they can do, one way that pirates are simply tracked down is by measuring the signal strength and basic triangulation, which really isn't that difficult on the FM dial, often complicated in dense urban areas because you might have a whole block of buildings. It's difficult to get down to just the one building, and you look for visual signs like antennas and such. But trading off, it certainly must complicate things.
Yeah, a little bit. It doesn't make it impossible for the FCC to find out who these people are. It just makes them have to go out more often.
Right. Well, that's it. And again, when you talk about these limited resources that the commission has to dedicate to all enforcement actions.
Right.
And meanwhile, having to hit every electronics store in lower Manhattan, which in and of itself is just an amazing task. Or even Brooklyn, you're talking about, and I think any complication to the amount of effort that needs to be spent really greatly increases the likelihood that someone's going to be able to broadcast fairly trouble-free from a longer amount of time.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that I think is ultimately interesting about the way that I keep the Enforcement Action Database, some of the statistics that I keep. I keep not only the number of visits and postal contacts and things like that, the raw data of what the FCC is actually doing, but I take the amount of money that the FCC is attempting to collect, and I compare it to how much effort they're actually putting in to enforcing.
So it's a crappy hourly wage, is what you're saying.
Basically, every action that the FCC engages in nets them. This is presuming that they collect all their fines, which typically they don't. They only collect a fraction of their fines, and the fines that they do actually collect on typically get reduced, like from $10,000 to $750, as was the case with someone hosting the transmitter for Free Radio San Diego earlier this year. For every action that the FCC does, even giving them the benefit of the doubt that they're collecting all the money, they're making $255. That's just for this year. Okay. Now, how much does it cost a field agent to go out, do the paperwork, take the complaint, fill out the forms, get in the car, spend the time?
It's
going to
be rough. It's
going to
be one day of at the very least.
If you figure in the wages and the benefits that it takes for that field agent to actually do the gas that it takes to drive around their explorers,
they probably must cost $300 a day.
They're not breaking even.
No,
it is a loss making situation for the FCC to go after pirates, and there is no way that the enforcement capabilities of the FCC are going to make pirates a source of revenue. They can't bust them and fine them enough to make enough money to recoup the cost of actually getting them, and that's something that I find to be very highly ironic and also somewhat strategically important.
And you are listening to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Rees-Bonnell. I'm your host, and my guest today is John Anderson to do our periodic, probably at least twice a year, we do a full-on half hour on pirate radio, because John keeps the website called DIYmedia.net, where he keeps news items posted to his blog, and importantly, as we're talking about today, the Enforcement Action Database, logging all of the known actions taken against unlicensed and pirate radio broadcasters throughout the country, and putting it into a form that we can begin to understand this data and make sense out of it and tell fiction from fact about the reality of unlicensed radio, how effective it is, and how much there really is going on versus what are the real risks of getting caught. And you can check out Media Geek online at MediaGeek.net. That's www.MediaGeek.net, as well as the radio program at Radio.MediaGeek.net. You can download it. You can also subscribe to the podcast. Get it automatically downloaded to your computer in MP3 or the Ogg Vorbis format. If you have any comments, please send them to me, Paul@MediaGeek.net. So we've established that New York is number one, and overall, the number of actions have been going up, though, that the FCC is taking against pirates.
Yes, the number of actions has been increasing significantly, especially over the last 3 years. In 1997, there were 42 enforcement actions, 1998, 118, and then it was below 100 for 3 years, and these were during the LPFM years. This, I think, was a time where the FCC kind of laid off on pirate broadcasters as a way of offering an olive branch to those who were pushing for low-power FM radio stations.
Yeah, licensed stations.
Yes. And then following the passage of the LPFM service and its implementation, enforcement actions against the FCC started to increase, or against pirates by the FCC started to increase. In 2002, there were 89. In 2003, there were 102, about the same in 2004. In 2005, there were 152. In 2006, that nearly doubled to 289, and right now for 2007 we're sitting at 246,
with about 2 months, almost 3 months left.
Yeah, almost 3 months left in the year, and they're on track to beat the record that they set last year.
So does this mean it's getting more dangerous to be a radio pirate?
No. No, it really doesn't. First of all, there is a certain way by which the FCC is artificially inflating its enforcement totals. For example, in New York, when they go out and they find a pirate broadcaster, not only do they issue a warning letter to the pirate broadcaster's residence, but they issue, and if typically they're in an apartment building, they'll issue a warning letter to the company that owns the building. Suddenly, I have two data points for one visit. Right.
And that's a way of sort of putting on some intimidation tactic.
Yes. It's a way of putting on an intimidation tactic and saying, you know, hey, landlord, one of your tenants is breaking the law. You might want to do something about it. But it inflates the apparent enforcement activity of the FCC. And that's something that you have to take into consideration when you read these statistics. The other thing that you have to keep in mind when you look at these is that the if you break down the type of enforcement actions that that are taking place, they are still primarily visits from guys with clipboards and letters in the mail. They are not fines. They are not jackbooted thugs with guns busting indoors and raiding stations. They are not court injunction. Yeah, I keep data on arrests, raids,
and so,
equipment seizures,
and so what is it?
Stuff.
So when you talk about the police action then, when they involve the federal marshals or when they've involved an actionable injunction and either the police come in or equipment is seized, how is that data? I mean, is that going up? Because
no.
I don't hear
no,
it.
That is
usually
not.
That's the ones that really hit the news, right? Those are the ones that you're really going to read about. And I'm not reading about more of them.
The only place that you hear about those issues is in Florida. Primarily.
And that's primarily local police who have
those
the power
police,
to go
right.
after these broadcasters
but
on
no,
their own.
The FCC is not working more closely with federal marshals in order to execute more station raids. It's simply not happening.
And that's because it's probably another order of magnitude of administrative hassle and expense, not to mention that you have to convince the local federal prosecutor and to go forward and to bring the federal marshals in to convince them that this is worth their time.
Looking over all 10 years of data that I have collected on FCC enforcement action, more than 72% of all enforcement activity has been explicitly postal in nature, meaning here's a warning letter, you're a bad person, or a knock on the door, hi, we're the FCC, what are you doing? A visit. No, nothing more punitive than that. Nearly three quarters of all enforcement activity that I've logged over 10 years has been nothing more than, hi, we're here and we know you exist. The number of raids that have taken place constitutes less than 10% of total enforcement activity.
And has that stayed pretty static across, from year to year?
Well, that went up in certain years. For example, in 1998, where there was a spike in the number of enforcement actions, part of that spike was due to a massive multi-site raid conducted by FCC agents in Florida. You might remember that because they
that
hit
was under
several,
Chairman Kennard,
right?
Was it?
They hit Lonnie Cobras and Doug Brewer, Tampa's Party Pirate, all these stations in one day in October, and that was a pretty significant one-off event. We have never seen militarized sweeps like that since 1998.
It was probably very expensive, not just from a financial standpoint, but from a political standpoint.
And it's also important to mention that the enforcement activity that we're talking about here is concentrated by and large on the FM band alone. Over the course of the entire 10 years, more than 95% of all enforcement activity has been concentrated on FM piracy. AM and shortwave piracy, 3.3% of that activity. And there has not been any documented enforcement action against a shortwave pirate in more than 5 or 6 years now.
So it's really, even though there are continues to be shortwave pirates, it's
and
simply...
And they've grown. And the shortwave pirate scene has grown significantly within the last couple of years.
And that's a whole other conversation.
Yeah.
But clearly, they're focusing on FM, which obviously is where the traditional broadcasters are going to be most aware and most screaming for action. And as well, they're probably the most visible. Mm-hmm. Well, we have about a minute left here, John. So very quickly, you said New York's number one. We got Florida...
Florida was number two. Number three is California, and number four is New Jersey, and the top five is rounded out with Massachusetts.
Massachusetts.
Primarily pirates operating in the Boston area.
In the Boston area. Well, so people can learn a lot more about what's going on in the current unlicensed radio scene, as well as other issues of importance to those of us who think we should be able to freely communicate at DIYmedia.net. John Anderson is the man who keeps that site up and running. Thanks once again for coming by.
It's always a pleasure.
That brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. I'm host and producer Paul Riesmandel. I'll be back in 1 week with another half-hour look at independent and grassroots media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. In the meantime, check out the frequently updated Media Geek blog at MediaGeek.net. The program can also be downloaded at Radio.MediaGeek.net, where you can subscribe to the podcast. Media Geek is produced at Community Radio WEFT in Champaign, Illinois, and is heard on 10 other community stations around North America, including KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, KQRP in Salida, California, KRBS in Oroville, California, WSLR in Sarasota, Florida, WTND Macomb, Illinois, WRFA in Jamestown, New York, CKDU in Halifax, Nova Scotia, WYQZ in Warrenton, Bealeton, Virginia, KWMD Kasilov in Anchorage, Alaska, WVEW in Brattleboro, Vermont, and Free Radio Olympia in Olympia, Washington. It's also on the web at Free Radio San Diego, Pirate969.org, and RadioDriftless.org. Media Geek is free to air on your local non-commercial station, too. Just email Paul at MediaGeek.net. That's also where you can send comments about the program, Paul at MediaGeek.net. Thanks for tuning in.